Acts 13 is where we are. We'll start with Acts chapter 13, verses 33 and 34. We're still in the midst of Paul's sermon. We've said a time or two that this is the first recorded sermon by Paul in the book of Acts. Sort of like Stephen back in Acts chapter 7, he goes back and recites some Jewish history. Beginning in 33, we'll kind of pick up. This is really the second part of the sermon, three-point sermon. He says that God hath fulfilled the same unto our children, in that he hath raised up Jesus, as also it is written in the second psalm, Thou art my son, this day have I begotten thee. And as concerning that he raised him up from the dead, now no more to return to corruption, he hath spoken on this wise, I will give you the holy and sure blessings of David. Now that ties into what we were talking about last time as far as verse 32. Paul said, we bring you good news. There are good tidings. And he says, this good tidings, this good news is about the promise. And he says, this promise was made unto the Father. Well, unto the fathers. So he says, there was the promise, verse 32, and now he gets into the promise, that's Jesus. And he says that promise, of course, about Christ was promised way back in the Old Testament system under the psalmist in Psalm 2. Now, when we think about Jesus being raised up, normally what comes to mind? Jesus was raised up. All right, we think about the resurrection, his coming back from the dead. Normally that description does describe Jesus' resurrection from the dead. And if you look, you find that that is the meaning of the word or the expression of verse 34, concerning him that was raised up from the dead. Well, obviously that's a resurrection. But you also have this idea in 33. But there it's not the resurrection. God hath fulfilled the same unto our children in that he's raised up Jesus. It's not the resurrection there. What's the raised up in 33? Well, no. He was raised up in that sense too. You've got this promise, 32, and he raised him up. Raised him up to do what? All right, to do the job. So you really have raised up in all three senses. I'm glad you brought that out, Ray. Raised up in the sense of he's going to come. He was promised, raised up to do that. Raised up in the sense that he did come and now he's been put to death. He's raised up from the dead. And then finally raised up in that third sense that Ray pointed out, and that is raised up to go to heaven. So God made these promises. Peter went back to that same subject back in Acts chapter 3, verses 24 through 26. One source said this, I'll give you the quote, to raise up Jesus in fulfillment of the patriarchal promises was to bring him into the world to perform his messianic mediatorial work. Luke used the same concept of raising to refer to the birth and the ascension of stubborn Pharaoh. Remember that story? God raised him up, Romans 9, to show him his power. And the advent of false religious teachers into the church in Ephesus, Acts chapter 20 and verse 30. So Paul talked about how they were going to come, they were going to rise within the flock, false teachers, people who were not going to teach the truth. We want to have our finger back on the second psalm. We're actually going to kind of read through that and study through that. It is a very important psalm for a number of reasons. You have some citations of that in the book of Acts. So, Kathy, would you hand me a Kleenex? I don't need it for my nose. I just need it for the Bible. I want to mark that in Psalm 2. That'll be a little easier for me to get back. So thank you very much. Okay, as far as Psalm 2, you have some manuscripts, and you may have a marginal note about this that will say Psalm 1. Anybody have that as far as a marginal note? In Acts chapter 13, it refers you back to the first Psalm. Okay. Well, that's interesting. I'm not quite sure why it would refer to the 27th Psalm. So if you find something there that's interesting, go ahead and raise your hand if you will. We'll take a look at it. When you look at the second psalm, it's not very long. And yet, even though it's not very long, you have in the New Testament about 60% of the second psalm quoted somewhere, sometimes more than once. Now, as you go back and you look at this psalm, you have in the first three verses the reaction of world rulers when it came to Jesus. And here's what the psalmist was predicting. When Jesus came into the world, he did his work, the apostles were going out, and really, ultimately, throughout the Christian age, he says, why do the nations rage? And the peoples meditate a vain thing. The kings of the earth, they set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together. Against Jehovah, and against who? Verse 2, against his anointed. Well, who do you think that is? It's Jesus. He says, let us break their bonds together, cast away their cords from us. So Jesus was going to come into the world, and the psalmist said, the world, the rulers, the officials, they're going to be opposed to him. And that's really about what you find. When you go back to a section a little earlier in the book of Acts, back in Acts chapter 4, verses 25 through 28, you also find some verses from Psalm 2 quoted there. John, as he talks about this in the book of Revelation, and I'm going to read this for you, in Revelation chapter 19 and verse 19, he's not quoting the second psalm, but he picks up the same idea that the world has always been very hostile to Christ and his people. In 19:19, John said, "And I saw the beast and the kings of the earth." Well, again, we've read about them back in Psalm 2. "The kings of the earth and their armies. And they were gathered together." Why do you think the kings of the earth got their armies together? What's the king bringing out his armies for? Really, only there are one of two choices. All right, you could put them on display. Sometimes they do that, but the primary purpose is going to be war. You get the armies together because you're going to fight someone. Who's the war against? They made war against him that... Revelation 19:19. Sat upon the horse. Well, who do you think that is? Christ. It's Christ. And not only that, and against who? His army. Well, who's the army of Christ? Christians. So, Psalm 2 says, look, this is what's going to happen. Revelation 19:19, John said, this is happening. And Peter cites that back in Acts chapter 4. So, really, throughout the entire Christian era, you begin to find that people are not only opposed to God, but people have been opposed to God's people. Now, I didn't originate this information. I came across just the other day, and I thought, well, you know, at some point, this just looks like good stuff. So, I'm going to put it on the computer and hold it. And sure enough, for Bible class this week, I thought this is appropriate. So, what I'm going to tell you came from a very smart man. And I think it's worth sharing as far as where we are in our study in the book of Acts. When you think about evil, do you see a distinction as far as how many in our world describe evil? What their vision or understanding of evil is and what the Christian understanding of evil is? Christian understanding of evil is what? What's evil? All right, sin. When God says, this is my law and you break my law, then that's sin, that's evil, that's wrong. If you look at people, though, who are not so interested in Christianity, how do they define evil? What's evil for them? Well, okay, that would be a good general definition. If we narrow that down a little bit, what would we find? Well, okay, I think that's breaking it down a little bit, and that's good. What if they say we have the poor in society, and it's wrong to have the poor? Do you hear that from some people? You have poor people that you're not caring for, that's evil. Well, that's certainly not good, but that's not evil in the sense that we would look at evil. What about some people who have our system of government often on their minds? Capitalism. Are there some people who run around and say, that's evil? Now, you might not like that system of government, and you certainly have that right. And as you look at that, you would also find that there are some other people who say, if you love your country, that's evil. So we've had, in our day and time, some people come along and they've started to take things like evil and redefine it. Well, that's a real problem. We might be able to see through that, but what about some kids who are being taught? If they go through school and they begin to hear that evil is this and this and this, and it's not this as far as what the Bible says is evil, that's wrong. Now, I'm not saying that some of those things are necessarily right. I mean, again, just ignoring the poor and... doing some bad things when it comes to the nation, certainly not right. But they've redefined it. All right, when you begin to think about the unsaved, as they look at mankind, they say, well, man's really part of what? Man's just part of... This might be a harder answer. All right, the animal kingdom, nature, is kind of a general word that we could toss in there. But when you look at God, don't you get the opposite view? Man is not just part of nature. Man is... Elevated, he was made in the image of God. So you have two very divergent, two completely opposite views. Then as you begin to think about the world says man is going to last for how long? All right, short time. You're here for a little bit and then you vanish away and you're gone. You're done. We can put up a memorial or a marker. We can name a street after you, but you're gone. But what's the Bible version? All right, you come here for a very short period of time. This is sort of like a testing, a proving grounds, and then you go on to another place that is eternal. Those two views are very, very opposite, saying that there is no life beyond this earth. The other one says there is. What about the idea that people are born a certain way? Person says, I was born this way, I was made this way, and that's the way I am. What's God say?
You have a choice.
Remember back there in Joshua chapter 24, it's about verse 15. What? This day? Choose you this day. They were able to make a choice. We have free will.
And we're still made in the image of God, and God is not evil.
Yes. But people will make that point that I don't have any control over this, that, or the other thing because this is how my body was configured, or I've got these genes, or whatever it might be. What about when we think about creation? Male and female, made by God or not?
Yes.
At the beginning. And when you think about male and female, did God give males and females specific roles? He did. And that's what we find in the beginning. And yet when you begin to look at the world, what do we find there? There's confusion. That's the perfect word. That's actually a Bible word when you go back to about Leviticus. They have messed things up. And once again, that confuses people, especially young people. And then as we think about that, the world bristling at the idea that God has made male and female and that there are specific roles. What about family? If you look at things from a biblical perspective, do you have family defined in a somewhat specific way?
Yes.
For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And from that union, oftentimes, kids follow. That's the natural plan, the natural order for family. But the world comes along and says what when it comes to family? Family might be this, or it might be that, and really there's no way to define family. Now, sometimes family, because of various circumstances, there are some changes there, but we still have a definite pattern from God. The world says, when it comes to God and religion, what do you find? There is superstition. Only the ignorant people are religious. Only the weak-minded. That's for the people over here who are not very smart. And yet God says the beginning of wisdom is what? To acknowledge Him and to follow Him. So when you start looking at some of the things that in our day and time, our culture, are so popular and so prominent, can you see the war? We're in a war. Bible talks about this over in the book of Ephesians chapter 6, and that war's been going on for a long time. The psalmist, Psalm 2, said it's going to happen. John was talking about it. He says you've got Christ on his horse. His armies are with him. The kings of the earth are arrayed against him. They're going out to fight, and they're going to use every tool in their disposal to suck people in to their system of belief. Anything that you want to add or ask along those lines? Okay. The unsaved have waged war against God and his people in numerous ways throughout time, and as I said, that certainly includes the Christian era. But as you look back in Psalm 2, let's see what God's response is. You've got this war raging. What's God's reaction to verse 4? He that sits in the heavens is going to start wringing his hands and say, what are we going to do? He's going to laugh. Now, why would God laugh? You think he finds it funny? No, it's not laughing in the sense of, I think this is hilarious. It's laughing in what sense? Yeah, God says, are you really going to try this? You don't have the best way. There's no chance of success. This is the worst possible idea. And if you're going to try that, I'm just going to have to sit and watch you fail. The Lord, he says in verse 3, will have them what?
In derision.
Now, when you start thinking about the world and they have their plans and they spend their money, their millions or their billions or maybe even trillions of dollars, and they sit back and think, aha, we're going to get our way. Are they going to win some battles sometimes? Take over a school? Take over a state? Take over a country? Maybe it looks like they're taking over a certain section of the world. But God, as all of that stuff moves back and forth, the battle continues to wage, God says what still? I'm in control. And that's a helpful lesson for us because as we see some of this stuff unfold, it can be very distressing for a Christian. You're thinking, why don't people wake up? Why can't they see that this is really wrong? Why can't they see that this is a bad choice? But God says to his people, this is the way it's going to be. So as we see this unfolding, we need to realize that, I don't know if you want to say it was predicted. I think that's probably not a bad word here, but God says this is the way that things will occur. And then he says, then he will speak unto them in his wrath and vex them in his sore displeasure. You think some of the people who make those choices end up having some negative consequences that they have to endure? Well, they do. And then here it is. This is kind of bringing us back to Acts chapter 13. Yet God says, as the battle wages, what have I done? I have set my king. Who do you think that is? Christ. I've set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. And then let's come back to that. We're not ready for verse 7 and following quite yet. So you've got the king set on the hill of holiness. I think that's related to the church. That's important because as you think about Jesus and his being a king, there are some, when they talk about Christ and the kingdom, they say, when's that going to occur? Past, present, or future? They say it's going to occur in the future. Well, that is a problem for a lot of reasons, one of which we'll see when we study a little bit about premillennialism in just a little bit. But in Acts chapter 13 and verse 33, you find that he's raised up Jesus, as it's written in the second psalm, thou art my son, this day have I begotten thee. And tied in with that is, of course, Jesus being king. Remember back there in Acts chapter 2 and verse 33, before Peter tells people how to become a Christian, he said Jesus came, he died, he was raised up, and then he was, remember that key word, raised up, in what sense? He was exalted to the right hand of God. Exalted to serve as king. All right, in John, in Revelation chapter 19 and verse 16, talks about Jesus as reigning now. Well, if God has set, Psalm 2, if God has set Jesus as king, what's implied by that? Anybody ever, I was talking with Bob for just a minute about a little project I need to do at the house, and it involves some glue. You get some good glue, and you let it set for a while. What happens? Or you let some concrete set. What happens?
Hardens.
All right, it hardens. And not only does it harden, there was a fellow I read about the other day. I had lunch with some people from here yesterday that were going down to Columbia City. We talked about realtors for just a bit. And I told them I had actually done some reading about realtor horror stories. You never know where you're going to find a sermon illustration. And one of the stories that I remember reading from that little bit of reading was someone who decided, among other things, to take some concrete mix and pour it down all the sinks. Everything that was a toilet or sink, they did that. And the damage was so bad that they had to bulldoze a house. That stuff had set, and they just decided it's just going to be cheaper by the time we, you know, have to tear out the plumbing and everything. It's just going to be better to raise the house. So they did. Now, bearing that in mind, if that's the idea of set, back in Psalm and verse Psalm 2, 7 and 8, when God has set his king on Zion's hill, what do you think that means? God said, I put him there. And who's going to throw him off?
Nobody.
You can rage, and you can plan, and you can spend money, and you can do all the stuff that free will lets you do. But guess what? I have put him there. And even if you try to burn down the house, it's not going to work. He is going to reign. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, 24 through 26, you have Paul saying that Christ is going to reign until the end of time. It's only then that he's going to give up the kingdom. So people can fight against Christ. People can badmouth Christ. People can be killed who are Christ's people. The devil can do all kinds of bad things. But Jesus is going to continue to reign. And that is a very powerful point. Anything that you want to add or ask before we go back to Psalm 2 for a minute? Don?
Go back to your comment about things happen. And if they had wanted God to let this happen, then it's, you know, basically that's God's plan. But that doesn't mean that we have to sit down and say, well, that's God's plan, so I cannot do anything about it.
Right.
We as Christians must speak out because he works through us. It's not going to change unless it works through us.
That's absolutely right. When you think about being a light to the world, Matthew chapter 5 and verse 14, you know, Jesus said nobody puts their light under a bushel. So he does expect us to speak out. There's, you know, there's no way. It's like sewage coming. Illinois and Iowa are in a little bit better shape now because the river is going down. But if you've got a house, talked to Mom yesterday. I said, well, this is an early Mother's Day call. And Mom had seen some interviews on TV because they're right there in that area. And one fellow was a tow truck driver. And there were a lot of cars that had gotten caught in the flooding for whatever reason. And the tow truck driver was responsible for going out and, you know, the cars that are now able to be towed out, go and tow them out. Well, the cars, I don't know how long it takes to submerge before the foulness really sets in. But but it was just like a decaying body. And he said when you had to open up the vehicle, he said the stench just about knocked you off your feet. So when you think about that, I mean, there is that nasty stuff that needs to be dealt with in the best possible way. And the same thing is true about spiritual filth. Unless somebody goes in there and tries to clean it up, fix things, tries to reach in there with the gospel, it's not going to get any better. And God says it's not always pleasant. Sometimes you're going to have to be like the tow truck driver, and you're going to have to open that up. You know, Jude talked about snatching people out of the fire. And it's not always pleasant, but God says, that's what I want you to do. I want you to be that light to the world. That it? Okay. As we go back to the final section in Psalm 2, that's also related to the information that we have over here in Acts chapter 13. Back in Psalm 2, we talked about the king being set, verse 6. And then God says in verse 7 of Psalm 2, I will tell of the decree. Jehovah said unto me, thou art my son. So there you have the Father speaking unto Christ. This day, what's happened? I have begotten thee. Now, when you hear certain words, it's tempting sometimes, not only for us, but for some other people, to insert our own definition for the meaning of the term. What do you think some people immediately think of when they hear the word begotten?
Birth.
All right, birth. Made. I think that's going to be the word that I want to key in on. And if you apply that to Christ, Jesus is the begotten Son. Well, if you take begotten and you're thinking in terms of made, what are you going to draw as far as a conclusion about Christ? He's not deity. He's not eternal. Because if you are made, you are not a timeless being. Well, if that's what begotten means, then that's what begotten means. But that's not what begotten means. At least as it's applied to Christ. Here, as you go back to Acts chapter 13, it is virtually synonymous with raised up. Begotten and raised up, that is, he was brought to this place to do what needed to be done as far as fulfilling the promises. As you look at Psalm 2 and verse 7, it says, Jesus was not just begotten, but he was begotten when? He was begotten on a...
Today.
He was begotten on a day, today. Well, let's take a look at the book of Hebrews for a second. Start with Hebrews 1. We'll look at Hebrews 1 and verse 5, and then we'll slip over to the fifth chapter, and from there, look at verse 5 as well. Hebrews 1, 5. Anybody want to read that for us? Don, you're there.
To which of the angels did he ever say, you are my son? Today I have begotten you, and again, I will be a father to him, and he shall be a son to me.
Okay, you can see the reference to Psalm 5 there. And in Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 5. Don, back to you.
So also Christ did not glorify himself so as to become a high priest, but he who said to him, you are my son, today I have begotten you.
Okay, now Hebrews 5:5 is a little more helpful than Hebrews 1:1 or Hebrews 1:5. But again, both are going back to that Old Testament text. As you look at Hebrews 5:5, you get a little better insight as far as what the begotten involves. Not really begotten in the sense of Jesus just coming into the world. Begotten in what sense? Begotten and glorified. You see both ideas there in the text. All right. Raised from the dead. Glorified as the Son of God. And I think when you go back to Psalm 2, you can begin to see that as well. This day have I begotten thee. This day have I appointed thee to do the things that will fulfill the promises of God, the beginning of the rule. As you read ahead just a little bit more in Psalm 2, take a look at verse 9. You're my son. This day have I begotten thee. Well, if that's taken place, then what follows from that? Verse 8, ask of me, and I will give what? I'll give you the nations for thine inheritance, the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron. Thou shalt dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Well, let's bear that information in mind and build on it a little bit. You remember over there in the book of Matthew, chapter 28, Jesus has been raised from the dead. It's not long before he's going to go back to heaven. What does it say in Matthew chapter 28 and verse 18? All power, all authority has been given to me where? In heaven and on earth. This day I have begotten you as my son. This day you have the power that you need to rule. John picks up on this point at least twice in the book of Revelation, starting in Revelation chapter 2, verses 26 and 27, and then over in Revelation chapter 19 and verse 15. In Revelation 2:26, he says, "And he that overcometh, and he that keepeth my works unto the end, to him will I," that's Christ, "give authority over the nations. And he shall rule over them with a rod of iron, as the vessels of the potter are broken to shivers, as I also received of the Father." So Jesus said, "I've received great authority, and I've got the authority, I've got the power to also give my people authority, to let them share in that authority." And then that additional reference over in Revelation chapter 19 and verse 5. "And a voice came forth from the throne, saying, Give praise to our God, all ye his servants, ye that fear him, the small and the great." I'm sorry, I wanted 15. I need to go down 10 more verses. That just didn't look quite right. Revelation 19, 15. "And out of his mouth proceeds a sharp sword, that with it he should smite the nations, and that he should rule them," that is the nations, "with a rod of iron. And he treadeth the winepress of the fierceness of the wrath of God of the Almighty." So he's got that authority. He uses that authority. And going back to Acts chapter 13, Paul says in Acts 13 and verse 33, Jesus came. He was raised up from the dead. That is the resurrection in Acts chapter 13 and verse 34. And he's got now this kingly authority. And that fulfills the promise of God that was back there in verse 32. Remember, David was king. And Jesus was the fulfillment of David's descendant. God said, somebody's going to come who's going to be a descendant of David. I'm going to put him on the throne, and he's going to rule in a special way. Jesus was begotten for those purposes. All right, as you look, anything that you want to add or ask before we go back to Psalm 2 for just a bit? Okay. Now, going back there, let's take a look at Psalm 2 and verse 10. "Now, therefore," well, what's God done? He said, well, the nations are going to resist. I've selected my king. I've put him on the holy hill. "Now, therefore, O kings, you rulers, you resistors, be what? Be wise." Why be wise? How would they be unwise in the context of Psalm 2? Yes, they're going to say, let's be immoral, let's let our citizens do what they want, let's pursue what is unrighteous, let's make, you know, the kind of laws that we see sometimes being made in America right now. God says, don't do that. Be wise, O kings. Be instructed, who? Ye judges of the earth. Well, you think we have some judges? I don't know that these judges were quite like ours, but at least in principle. You think we have some judges that should be looking to God and his word? Yeah. You judges, what needs to be true for you? Well, be instructed, serve, worship the Lord with fear, rejoice with trembling. There's good news, but don't head off in the wrong direction. And then it becomes even a little more specific. Along with that fear, along with that rejoicing, along with that respect, what else should you do? Verse 12. What are the first few words in Psalm 2:12? Kiss the sun. Well, what kind of sun do you think that is? Sun that gives us heat? No. Kiss the sun. Which sun? Christ, the Son of God. How would you kiss the sun?
My version says do homage.
Well, that brought us there too quickly. All right, how do you do homage to the sun?
Obey.
All right, you obey him. You know, you not only love him, you not only respect him, but you decide that you're going to obey him. You submit to his authority. Now, that should be true for all people, but who's in the context? The kings, the judges, the people in power. Why is it important for those people to submit? There are at least a couple of reasons. All right. Things kind of flow downhill. So if you've got ungodly rulers, chances are the people are going to be ungodly. But the other thing, too, is if you're a ruler, you think you might be someone who's tempted to have some problems in the area of pride? Look at me. I'm the president of the country. There's nobody here. I say the word and you die. I say the word and you live. I say the word, you lose your house. I say the word, you get a free house. I'm the guy in charge. And God says to these people, you need to understand a little something about authority. You may have a lot of authority, but it doesn't compare to the authority of the Son. Going back to Matthew chapter 18, or Matthew 28 and verse 18, remember? Who has all authority? Christ. So whoever you are, even if you ruled over every person on the earth, even if you ruled over every country, you still are far less than the Son. So kiss, show obeisance to the Son. Lest who? He, who do you think that is? The Son, Christ, be what? Angry. And who? You perish in the way. Sounds a little bit like what Jesus said over Luke 13:3, doesn't it? Repent or perish. And then he says in that's the end of it, as far as that first part of verse 12, for his wrath will soon be kindled. Blessed are all they that take refuge in him. Isn't that the message that we really find in the New Testament? Turn to Christ, and what do you have? Refuge, salvation, all spiritual blessings. So that is the great message there. One of the passages from the book of Revelation, I think John does a good job of showing from Revelation 6 what happens to people, especially important people, when they refuse to follow Christ. It's a nice complimentary text to wrap things up. In Revelation 6:15, it says, the kings of the earth and the princes and the chief captains and the rich and the strong and every bondman and freeman. So he gets everybody, but he certainly starts at the top, the kings. He says, they hid themselves in the caves and in the rocks of the mountains, and they say to the mountains and to the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him that sits on the throne. Well, that's the guy that we've been talking about, Jesus, and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of the wrath has come, and who is able to stand? John goes back and reinforces this point once again. Christ has all authority. If you're not willing to submit to that authority, you will be lost. You might be rich, you might be powerful, you might be famous. It does not matter who you are. You will be lost. So you find that point running throughout Scripture, and it is a very, very important point. So the Messiah, Paul says, has come, and you folks have an obligation to obey him. Remember what Jesus said? We talked about this in a recent class. The Jews kind of thought, well, we're connected to Abraham and we've got the history to Moses and we're good. What were they told? God can raise up these children from these stones. So don't get on your high horse and think that you're good. You're not. Verse 34 in Acts chapter 13 summarizes the point a bit. It includes a reference back to Isaiah chapter 55 and verse 3. I highlighted that just a bit ago. God made some promises to David. David was not going to get to build the temple, but God said, look, there's another path here, and it's also going to be a very special path. It's going to be fulfilled later. You're not going to live to see it. You can start working on the supplies and get everything lined up, but you're not going to be able to build the temple. But God said to David, you are going to have a descendant, and this descendant is going to do some amazing things. And that's true, as we see some from Jesus. You also have Paul making this point, which would have helped distinguish Jesus. He says, unlike David, Jesus was in a different category. David experienced corruption. What do you think the corruption there is? Death. All right, death. Body's going to be around for a period of time. It's going to be decaying. It's going to turn to dust. When he says David's descendant was not going to be like that, David saw corruption, but Jesus didn't see corruption. He's implying what? Jesus was... All right, he was raised from the dead. So he's saying... That's what he was trying to indicate by no decay. And Paul says, I believe it's going back there to verse 34, God's promises have proven to be sure or true. And one of the ways that we know that is that Jesus was raised from the dead. So that one act of God's power, the resurrection, tells us that Satan can't overcome God's promises. Also, God does not fail in what he promises. I do want to introduce this point quickly. We should know it, but it doesn't hurt to go back and look at this again. I'll phrase it in a somewhat tricky way. Does God always fulfill his promises? Okay, so we've got a yes. We've got an eventually. Anybody want to toss in a third answer? Well, okay. His timing. Well... That kind of opens up a new vein of thought. Does God change his mind? Yes. Really? God changes his mind. So, we talk about God on the one hand as far as knowing the end from the beginning, right? So if you know that, would you really change your mind? I mean, maybe we would think of it in those terms. Yeah, I think we when we see that, God changed his mind, not in the sense that it's like us, not that we're whimsical, but the change of mind there is more of God says, I have a promise which is conditional. If you do this, this is going to be the result. If you do that, this is going to be the result. People chose this, so God changed his mind in the sense that we're going to go in the other direction. So that opened up that vein of thought, which I appreciate, and I think that's helpful to remember that not all God's promises, or some of God's promises are conditional. So when somebody says, does God always fulfill his promises, it's always good to ask a little bit more, what do you mean by that? Do you recognize that some of God's, for example, go back to Jonah, 40 days, what's going to happen? Nineveh is going to be destroyed. Well, somebody says, well, God changed his mind. Well, what do you mean by that? There was a conditional promise. It's going to be destroyed, asterisk, unless what? Unless you repent. They did repent, so what happened? No destruction. So sometimes there are at least two different roads there, and God says, choose A, okay. But if you don't choose A, we're going to go down road B. Carol, did you have a thought there? And then we'll take Don's point. I think sorrow would be a pretty good way to describe that. Because once again, if God knows the end from the beginning, he knew what people were going to choose, and that's sad. I think even for us, we, not exactly, but if we are a parent, or we become a parent, and we think about the future of our child, as we look at that, if we know that our child is going to reach an accountable age, and our child is going to have the mental capacity to process things, do we not know that our child's going to sin? Do we not know that our child's going to sin? Yes or no?
Yes.
Okay. What allows us to say definitively yes? All right. God has made that promise. If you get old enough and you are mentally accountable, you will sin. Everybody. Well, could we have maybe that sorrow? I mean, that's going to, that one day our son, our daughter, our kids that we dearly love, that they're going to go off that track of innocence and they're going to make some bad choices. So there's that pain there, I guess, that you might have. And God, as he looked at his children, I think that you have to say that there was that regret in the sense that it pained him because that day did come. Just like we know that day is going to come for us. So it's not a perfect parallel, but I think that maybe helps us a little bit there, hopefully. Did you have a follow-up?
Well, I was just thinking, well, yes, we know everybody sins, so we were sorry one person's going to sin, we should be sorry everybody.
Oh, that's true. Sin. That is very true. Don, we'll start with you next.
Well, God always keeps his promise. It may be an A or B.
Yeah.
That you can select from the bookends, from the creation to the end of the world.
Yeah.
Those are two promises he's kept. He will keep. So, yeah. I think God is always sorrowful when somebody dies and they're not a Christian. They're not saved. Because it said that in John 3:16, that none should perish. So, that none should perish, I think he's grieved when people perish without Jesus.
Well, here's an interesting thought for you to toss around. Luke 15. Remember, Jesus talks about, you know, the woman who lost a coin and the son who comes back. And he says there's more rejoicing in heaven over one that comes back than the 99 that never left. So I think that we can extract from that that there's rejoicing in heaven. I think that's a fair statement. God is pleased when you look at some of the Old Testament statements about sacrifice. So here's a thought that I had never considered before. If you have all this knowledge and you see people, I would assume that this takes place every day, not because of the world population, but every day I can see, or I would think at least pretty close to every day, that you have people who have reached the age of accountability. Yesterday, for example, they were not in that boat. Today they are. They reached that transition mark. And you see people become accountable for sin. Day after day after day. If you have that knowledge, to me, I would think that that would bring some form of grief or some form of unpleasantness. That would be the opposite side of rejoicing in heaven, Luke chapter 15. So if that's true, heaven has to be a really interesting place. I think if I were going to go out on a limb a little bit, angels, we know that they're interested in seeing what's taking place. If they're interested in seeing the wayward come back, one wonders, at least I would wonder, if that person who has now become involved with sin, chargeable for sin, and if a person dies in that state, that individual is going to be eternally separated from God. I think I would be interested in kind of seeing what are going to be the events in that person's life as they begin to unfold. Are there going to be things in their life they're done to somehow get the gospel to them? So I'm not sure all the things that take place in heaven, but I imagine that there might be a whole lot more watching as far as things on the earth than we might imagine. So. Angels. Yeah, like I say, in heaven. If you're interested in the one, people coming back. To me, it would make sense that the flip side of that, the people who are now chargeable for sin, are they going to find salvation? How far in sin are they going to go? So it could be a very interesting thing to be in heaven and kind of see what's taking place on earth. That it? Okay, about 3 minutes left, and some things that I wanted to talk about concerning premillennialism. Let me at least give you kind of the basic rundown here, and then we'll see where we are as far as making a division. When you talk to people who believe in premillennialism, and this is true for just about any religious doctrine, I think wise preachers have changed their practices over the years when somebody says, well, I'm from this particular group, or I believe in this doctrine. Be careful about assuming. Let's use this illustration. Somebody says, I'm Mennonite, or somebody says, I'm Amish. Now, maybe several years ago, you could have drawn some conclusions, and you could say, aha, if you're Amish, I know what you believe. If you are Mennonite, I know what you believe. Today, if you made that assumption, you think you might be a bit embarrassed?
Yes.
Because there's pretty much a wide range there. When somebody says, I'm Amish, well, that can mean a lot more things, I think, now than what it used to, and the same thing is true for Mennonite. That's also true when you talk to people who are involved with premillennialism. They may say, well, you know, I believe in the thousand-year reign or something. Well, are you pre-trib? Are you post-trib? They're just all kinds of different ideas. So if somebody says, I believe in premillennialism, or I think that Jesus is coming back to reign on earth, you might ask several questions to see exactly what the belief is. If you don't have that narrowed down, that's not going to work out too well. But so there's some common things that you will find with people for the most part, who believe in premillennialism. First of all, they would say that the land promises to Israel were not fulfilled. They're looking for those land promises to be fulfilled at some future point. And we'll go ahead and, I guess, start there next week. We'll look at a few passages. Maybe write these down next week. So if you do talk to somebody who is involved with premillennialism, and they start talking about, well, the land's going to be given to the Jews and so forth, and this relates to some of those promises that we were talking about a little bit ago.